Gargoyle Nail.
You've only got one chance, said Malcolm. Tell me everything, and I'll put in a word for you. If you don't do that, you'll face a murder charge.
You and the police, said Morris.
No, I'm something else, but don't get distracted by that. I know enough already to put you in the dock for murder. Tell me about George Paston.
Something of the defiance went out of Morris, and his demon backed away as far as she could get from Asta, who simply stood and watched.
He's bent. He's a copper, all right, but he's as twisted as hell. He'll do anything, get you anything, steal anything, hurt anyone. I knew he was a killer, but I never seen him do it. Not till...
Well, it was Paston who killed the other man.
Yeah. Couldn't have been me. He'd done my fucking leg by then. I was on the ground. I couldn't move nowhere.
Who was the victim?
I don't know. No need to know. I didn't care who the hell he was.
Why did Paston want to attack him?
Orders, I suppose.
Orders from whom? From where?
Paston. He's got someone over him who tells him what jobs he wants done, right? I don't know who that is.
Paston's never given you any clue?
No, I only know what he tells me, and he keeps a lot of it close to his chest. That's all right with me. I don't want to know anything that'll get me into trouble.
Oh, you're in trouble already.
But I never killed him, never! That wasn't part of the plan. We was just supposed to smack him a bit and take his bag, his rucksack, whatever he was carrying.
Did you take it?
No, because he wasn't carrying nothing. I says to George, he must have had something. He must have left it in the station or passed it to someone else.
When did you say that? Before or after he was killed?
I can't remember. It was an accident. We never meant to kill him.
Malcolm wrote for a minute, 2 minutes, three. Morris sat slumped without moving, as if all the strength had gone out of him, and his demon was whimpering at his feet. Asta, still on guard in case the demon made a sudden move, sat down carefully, but kept watching. Then Malcolm said, "This man who tells Paston what to do."
"What about him?"
"Does Paston never talk about him? Mention a name, for instance?"
"He's a scholar. That's all I know."
"No, it isn't. You know more than that." Morris said nothing. His demon was lying flat on the floor, her eyes closed tight. But as soon as Asta took a step towards us, she sprang up in alarm and backed away behind the man's chair.
"No," said Morris, flinching too.
"What's his name?" said Malcolm.
"Talbot."
"Just Talbot?"
"Simon Talbot."
"College?"
"Cardinals."
"How do you know?"
"Paston told me. He says he's got something on him."
"Paston knows something about him?"
"Yeah."
"Did he tell you what that was?"
"No, he was probably just boasting."
"Tell me as much as you know."
"I can't! He'd kill me, Paston. You don't know what he's like. There's no one else that knows this, only me. And if he finds out you know, he'll know it's come from me and... Oh, I've said too much already. I was lying. I never told you nothing."
"In that case, I'll have to ask Paston myself. I'll make sure he knows how helpful you've been."
No, please don't do that. He's a terrible man. You can't imagine what he'd do. Killing's nothing to him. That man by the river, he killed him like killing a fly. That's all it was to him."
"You haven't told me enough about this Talbot man at Cardinals. Have you met him?"
"No. How would I have done that?"
"Well, how did Paston know him?"
"He's the liaison officer for that group of colleges. If they need any police contact for any reason, he's the one they speak to."
That made sense to Malcolm. There were arrangements like that in place for all the colleges. The proctors, the university police, dealt with most matters of discipline, but it was thought to be good for town-gown relations to have regular, informal contact with the police. He stood up. Such was Morris's fear that he shrank back on his chair. Malcolm saw it, and Morris saw that he saw.
"If you say one word to Paston about this, I'll know," said Malcolm, "and you'll be finished."
Morris feebly caught at Malcolm's sleeve.
"Please," he said, "don't give me to him. He's..."
"Let go."
Morris's hand dropped away.
"If you don't want to end up on the wrong side of Paston, you'll have to keep your mouth shut, won't you?"
Malcolm said.
"Who are you, anyway? That card ain't real. You don't come from the Royal Mail."
Malcolm ignored him and walked out. Morris's demon whimpered.
"Simon Talbot," Malcolm said to Asta as they shut the door and walked away. "Well, well."
Chapter 13 The Zeppelin. Pantelimon knew he'd have to move at night and hide during the day. That was a given. It was also necessary to follow the river, because that would take him to the heart of London, and thence to the docks. And whereas there were plenty of places to hide along the riverbank, there would be far fewer beside the main roads. He'd deal with the city when he got there. It was harder going than he'd thought it would be. Roaming through Oxford under the moon was one thing, because he knew every corner so well. But he soon realized how much he'd miss Lyra's ability to look things up, to ask questions, to function successfully in a world of human beings. He missed that even more at first than he missed the softness of her flesh, the scent of her warm hair when it needed washing, the touch of her hands, and he missed those terribly. On his first night away, he couldn't sleep, no matter how comfortable the mossy fork of an old oak where he curled up. But it had been impossible. They couldn't live together. She'd become unbearable with her new, hard, dogmatic certainty and the condescending half-smile she couldn't conceal when he spoke of things she'd once been eager to hear about or criticized that loathsome novel which had so warped her understanding. And the Hypercharasmians was the center of his quest for the time being. He knew the author's name, Gottfried Brander. He knew Brander was, or had been, a professor of philosophy at Wittenberg. That was all he knew in the way of facts and reason, and it would have to do. But in the realm of dreams and thoughts and memories, he was perfectly at home, and perfectly certain. Someone had stolen Lyra's imagination, and he was going to find it, wherever it was, and take it home to her.
"What do we know about this Simon Talbot?" said Glenys Godwin.
The Oakley Street director was sitting in Charles Capes's rooms in Wickham College together with Capes and Hannah Ralph and Malcolm. The morning was clear and fresh, and the sun shone through an open window onto the richly spotted fur of Godwin's paralyzed demon, where he lay on Capes's desk. Godwin and Capes had both now read all the documents Malcolm had copied, and they had listened with interest to what Malcolm had found out from Benny Morris.
"Talbot's a philosopher," said Capes, so-called. "He doesn't believe in objective reality. It's a fashionable attitude among undergraduates with an essay to write. A flashy writer. Witty, if you like that sort of thing. Very popular lecturer. He's beginning to acquire a bit of a following among the younger scholars, mind you."
"More than a bit, I think," said Hannah. "He's rather a star."
"Do we know of any connection between him and Geneva?" asked Malcolm.
"No," said the whisper of Godwin's demon. "There could hardly be any common ground if he means what he says."
"I think the point is that he says nothing means anything very much," said Capes. "It might be quite easy for him to play at supporting the magisterium. I'm not sure they'd trust him, though."
"This police liaison business," said Glenys Godwin. "Talbot's college is Cardinals. Is that right?"
"That's right," said Hannah. "The colleges are organized in groups for that sort of thing. The others in that group are Fox, Broadgates, and Oriel."
"And presumably there's a scholar of each college responsible for communicating with the police if necessary."
"Yes," said Capes. "Usually a junior dean or someone of that sort."
"Find out, please, Charles. See what you can discover about Talbot and this Paston. Malcolm, I want you to concentrate on the rose oil. I want to know everything about it. The research station in Central Asia, what is it? Who runs it? What have they discovered about the oil, if anything? Why can't the roses be grown anywhere else? What's the truth about this extraordinary red building in the middle of the desert, with the Latin-speaking guards where the roses come from? Is it a delirious fantasy of some sort? I want you to go there yourself, as soon as possible. You know the place. You speak the language, I think."
Malcolm said, "Yes." That was all he could say. An order like that meant that he'd have no chance to search for Lyra, even if he'd known where to begin.
"And this unrest throughout the Levant and beyond, find out what's behind that. Is it coming from the Lopnor region and spreading west? Is it connected at all with the rose business?"
"There's something curious about that," said Malcolm. "In Strauss's diary, he mentions that some places not far from the research station have been attacked, rose gardens set on fire and so on, and he says he was surprised because he thought that sort of thing had been confined to Asia Minor, to Turkey and the Levant, basically. Maybe the unrest didn't originate in Central Asia at all,
but further west, nearer Europe. Glenys Godwin nodded and made a note. Find out what you can, she said, and went on. Hannah, the young woman, Lyra Silvertongue, any idea where she's gone?
None yet, but the alethiometer isn't good at hurrying. I think she's safe, but more than that I can't tell. I'll keep looking.
I'd like a brief account of her background and why she's important. I don't know whether she's central or peripheral. Can you put that together quickly?
Of course.
There's a file about her in the mausoleum, said Godwin's demon.
He meant the section of Oakley Street's archives in which inactive material was stored. Malcolm and Astor knew that, but couldn't help feeling a little dart of shock at the reminder of that dank and rotting graveyard where he'd killed Gerard Bonneville in order to save Lyra's life.
Good, said Godwin. I'll read it when we get back. In the meantime, something's happening in Geneva. Do you know anything about that, Charles?
A conference, or a congress, as they're calling it. All the various bodies of the magisterium are gathering for the first time in centuries. I don't know what's prompted it, but it doesn't sound good. The best weapon we have against them at the moment is their disunity. If they find a reason for coming together, and a way of institutionalizing it, there'll be a more formidable opposition than ever.
Could you find a way of getting there yourself?
Why, I dare say I could, but I'm already under suspicion, or so I've been told. They'd make sure I didn't learn very much. I do know one or two people who'd learn more, and wouldn't mind telling me about it. There are always journalists, scholars from various places attending and listening and reporting on events like that.
All right, whatever you can do. Let's keep in mind what's at the bottom of this. These roses, this oil they produce, is something the Magisterium is desperate to control. The main instigator in all this seems to be the organization called La Maison Juste, and its director, Marcel Delamere. Charles, do you know anything about them? Why is it called that, for instance?
La Maison Juste is the building where their headquarters are. The organization's full title is the League for the Instauration of the Holy Purpose.
Instauration, said Glenys Godwin. I've forgotten what that means, if I ever knew it.
It means restoration, or renewal.
And what is this holy purpose? Actually, don't bother, I can guess. They want to reinvigorate their sense of righteousness. They'd like a war. And for some reason, these roses will give them an advantage.
Well, we need to know what that is, and cancel it out, and if possible, gain it for ourselves. Let's keep that clearly in mind.
Oakley Street is hardly in a position to fight a war, said Hannah.
I was not actually advocating a war, said Godwin, but if we act intelligently and effectively, we might prevent one.
You know why I'm sending you in particular there, Malcolm. I wouldn't ask anyone else to go.
Malcolm did know, and so did Hannah, but Capes didn't, and was looking at him curiously.
It's because my demon and I can separate, Malcolm said.
Ah, said Capes. He looked at Malcolm and nodded. No one spoke for a few moments.
Something was glinting on the desk. The sunlight was catching the blade of a silver paper knife, and Malcolm felt the familiar presence of the tiny, shimmering point, no bigger than an atom, which would slowly become visible and then grow larger into the sparkling loop of light he knew as the Spangled Ring. Astor looked at him. She felt it too, though it wasn't visible to her. There was no point in his trying to focus on anything for a few minutes, because it would take that long for the ring to grow large enough to see through. So he relaxed his vision and thought about the four human beings in the room, so liberal and tolerant, so civilized, and the organization they embodied. In that wider perspective, Oakley Street seemed absurd. An organization whose very existence had to be concealed from the nation it had been set up to protect, whose agents were mostly now middle-aged or older, and fewer in number than ever, whose resources were so scanty that its director would have had to travel third class on a slow train from London, and he, Malcolm, would have to subsidize his own travel to Karamakan. What did this decrepit, poverty-stricken, understaffed body think it was doing, taking on the entire magisterium? The other three were talking quietly. As the sparkling loop of light drifted towards Malcolm, it encircled each of them in turn when he looked over at them. Charles Capes, slender, bald, faultlessly dark-suited, a red handkerchief in his top pocket, a deep and subtle intelligence in his eyes. Glenys Godwin, warmly dark-eyed, grey hair cut neatly, one hand tirelessly and tenderly caressing her wounded demon. Hannah Relf, who Malcolm loved only a little less than his own mother, slight and grey-haired and frail, whose mind held such knowledge. How valuable these people seemed in this other perspective, in the light of the spangled ring. So he sat and listened, and let it drift past him and disappear. As Charles Capes had said, it was the first Congress the hierarchy of the Magisterium had held for centuries. There was a hierarchy, in the sense that some of the bodies and individuals were junior and some senior, some more important and some less, but it was not a fixed hierarchy, as it would have been had Pope John Calvin left the church as he'd found it. Instead, he had repudiated the primacy of his office and divided its power among several agencies. After his death, the office of Pope was never filled again, and the authority that used to go with the title was diverted into many different courses, as a river that had run fast and narrow in the mountains slows down and spreads out, and cuts many new channels as it finds itself in the flatlands below. So, there was no one clear line of command. Instead, a multitude of different bodies, councils and colleges and committees and courts grew up, and if they found themselves under an ambitious and talented leader, flourished, or perished and withered if there was no boldness of vision or depth of courage among their governors. Altogether, the entity known as the Magisterium consisted of a seething mass of rivalrous, jealous, mutually suspicious bodies, similar only in their liking for power and their ambition to wield it. They came, the leaders of these factions, the director of the Consistorial Court of Discipline, the dean of the College of Bishops, the chairman of the Committee for the Propagation of the True Faith, the Secretary General of the Society for the Promotion of Celibate Virtue, the rector of the Red Chamber, the master of the School of Dogmatic Logic, the president of the Court of Common Order, the abbess of the Sisters of Holy Obedience, the archimandrite of the Priory of Grace, and many, many others. They came because they dared not stay away, in case their absence were interpreted as rebellion. They came from all over Europe, and from further south and north and west and east, some eager for conflict, some uneasy at the thought of it, some tempted like hounds by the gamey tang of heresy hunting, others reluctant to leave the peace of their monasteries or colleges for what was bound to be discord and anger and danger. Altogether, 53 men and women assembled in the oak-panelled council chamber of the Secretariat of the Holy Presence, which had the advantage of giving the prefect of that order the right to chair the meeting.
"Brothers and sisters," the prefect began, "in the name and the authority of the Most High, we are summoned here today to discuss a matter of burning importance. Our faith has, in recent years, been challenged and threatened as never before. Heresy is flourishing. Blasphemy goes unpunished. The very doctrines that have led us through 2,000 years are being openly mocked in every land. This is a time for people of faith to draw together and make our voices heard with unmistakable force. And, at the same time, there is opening to us in the East an opportunity so rich and promising as to raise the heart of the most despondent. We have a chance to increase our influence and bring our power to bear on all those who have resisted and are still resisting the good influence of the Holy Magisterium. In bringing you this news, and you shall hear much more later, I must also urge you all to pray most earnestly for the wisdom we shall need in order to deal with the new situation. And the first question I must put before you is this.
Power, ancient body, here represented by 53 men and women of the utmost faith and probity. Is it too large? Are there simply too many of us to make rapid decisions and act with force and effect? Should we not consider the benefits that would flow from delegating matters of great policy to a smaller, a more swift-moving and decisive council, which could provide the leadership that is so necessary in these distracted times?
Marcel Delamere, representing La Maison Juste, listened to the prefect's words with satisfaction. No one would ever know, but he himself had written the speech for the prefect to deliver. And he had made sure, by private inquiry, by blackmail, by bribery, by flattery, by threat, that the motion to elect a smaller council would be passed. And he had already decided who should be elected to it, and who should chair it. He settled comfortably back and folded his arms, and the debate opened. As darkness was falling at the edge of the fens, rain started to fall too. It was the time of day when Giorgio Brabant usually began to look for a likely spot to moor for the night, but as they were so close to his native waters, he was inclined to keep moving. He knew every twist and turn of these mazy waterways, and the lights he sent Lyra to mount at the stem and the stern were a matter of courtesy to any fellow boaters, not a necessity to show the way. "When do we get into the fens, Master B?" said Lyra.
"We're there now," he said. "More or less. There ain't no frontier nor customs post. Nothing like that. One minute you're out, the next minute you're in."
"So how do you know?"
"You got a feeling for it. If you're Egyptian, it's like coming home. If you ain't Egyptian, you feel uncomfortable, nervous. You feel that all them buggarts and horrors is out there in the water watching you. Don't you feel that?"
"No."
"Oh, well, we can't be there yet. Or else I ain't told you enough stories."
He was standing at the tiller, in oilskins and sou'wester, while Lyra sat just inside the doorway wrapped in an old coat of his. The stern light threw a yellow outline around his bulky form and lit up the incessant raindrops that filled the air. Lyra was aware of the potatoes cooking on the naphtha stove in the galley behind her. She'd go in soon and cut some slices of bacon to fry. "When do you think we'll get to the Zaal?" she said. She was referring to the great meeting hall, the center of the Egyptian's communal life.
"Ah, well, there's a way to tell that."
"What is it?"
"When you're close enough to see it, you're almost there."
"Well, that's helpful. I must—" He suddenly put up a hand to hush her, and at the same moment his demon turned her head to the sky. Brabant sheltered his eyes with the brim of his sou'wester and peered up too, and Lyra followed their example. She could see nothing, but heard a distant rumble from the clouds.
"Lyra, run forward and douse that glim," said Brabant, easing the throttle back and reaching out with his other hand for the stern light.
The light at the prow was reflected along the length of the cabin roof, so Lyra could see easily enough to run along and jump down into the bows. When she reached up and turned the wick down to extinguish the flame, she could hear the sound more easily, and a moment later she could see the source of it, the pale, egg-like form of a zeppelin, cruising slowly some way behind them on the starboard side, below the clouds and showing no lights. She felt her way back to the cockpit. Brabant had steered the maid in towards the side and cut the engine to a murmur, and Lyra felt a little jolt as the boat touched the grassy bank.
"You see it?" he said quietly.
"I can see one. Are there more?"
"One's enough. Is it following us?"
"No, I shouldn't think they can have seen the lights yet, not through this rain. And the noise that engine is making, they'd never be able to hear ours."
"I'm going to move along then," he said.
He pushed the throttle forward, and the engine responded with a gentle rumble. The boat moved on. "How can you see?" said Lyra.
"Instinct. Keep your trap shut. I need to listen."
She remembered the potatoes, and ran inside to take them off the stove and drain them. The warm, comfortable old cabin, the clean galley, the steam, the smell of the cooked potatoes, they felt like a bulwark against the danger above. But she knew they were nothing of the sort, and that a bomb, well aimed, would kill her and Brabant and sink the Maid of Portugal in a matter of moments. She hurried from end to end of the boat, checking all the blinds. There wasn't a single chink. Finally, she put out the light in the galley and went back to the cockpit. The roar of the Zeppelin's engine was loud now. It sounded as if it was directly overhead. She squinted up through the lashing rain and could see nothing. "Psst," said Brabant quietly. "Look out, starboard." Lyra stood and stared out as hard as she could, ignoring the rain in her eyes, and this time saw a little flickering greenish light. It was inconstant, but it always came back after vanishing for a second or two, and it was moving. "Is that another boat?" she said.
"It's a will-o'-the-wick, a jack-o'-lantern."
"There's another." A second light, reddish in colour, appeared and disappeared not far from the first. Lyra watched them approach each other, touching, disappearing, and then flickering up again a little way apart. The Maid of Portugal continued to move ahead, steady and slow, as Brabant kept checking left and right, listening, peering, even lifting his face to sniff at the air. The rain was beating down harder than ever. The marsh light seemed to be keeping pace with the boat, and then Lyra realized that the Zeppelin overhead had moved a little in their direction, as if to see what they were. The engine sounded very loud, very close, and she wondered how the pilot could see anything at all in the murk. The Maid of Portugal was leaving no wake, and every light on board was out. "There's another one," Lyra said. A third light had joined the first two, and now they set up a weird, halting, pausing, swerving dance. The cold, inconstant glimmer made Lyra feel uneasy. Only the solid deck beneath her feet and the bulky presence of Giorgio Brabant saved her from a sickly fear of things that were outside, just beyond the reach of reason, inhabiting the dark.
"It's going that way," said Brabant.
He was right. As if it was being pulled, the Zeppelin was moving to starboard, toward the marsh lights. Brabant pushed the throttle further forward, and the narrow boat picked up speed. In the faint glimmer of the marsh lights, Lyra could see him straining every sense. And Annika, his demon, jumped up onto the cabin roof, head moving this way and that to catch a fragment of scent that would help avoid a mud bank or steer round a bend. Lyra almost said, "Can I help?" but realized as she opened her mouth that if he had a task for her, he'd tell her. So she sat down in the doorway again and kept still, and looked out to starboard, where the marsh lights were flickering more brightly than ever. Suddenly, a line of fire streaked down towards the marsh lights from the teeming sky above. It hit the water and exploded in a blossom of orange and yellow flame, and a moment later Lyra heard the brief whistle of the flight and the solid crump of the explosion. The marsh lights went out all at once.
"There," said Brabant, "they broke the law now. They're allowed to fly over, but not to do that."
Annika was growling as she stood four square and gazed at the rapidly fading glow from the rocket. A moment later, a dozen marsh lights flickered again, moving swiftly, darting here and there, even rising and falling. Little jets of fire spurted up from the ground to flare and go out in a moment.
"That's made 'em angry," said Brabant. "Trouble is, they're showing us up."
The boat was still purring forward into the dark, but he was right. The marsh lights were so fierce and brilliant now that, small as they were, they illuminated the whole length of the Maid of Portugal, streaming with rain and catching every flicker of light.
"They don't like us, the will-o'-the-wixes, but they like them Zeppelins even less," Brabant said. "But they still don't like us. Wouldn't bother them a bit if we got sunk and drowned, or smashed into 1,000 splinters."
Annika suddenly barked, a short yap of alarm. She was looking up, and Lyra, following her gaze, saw a little shape falling from the Zeppelin and briskly unfolding into a parachute. Almost at once, the wind caught it and tossed it backwards. But a moment later, the black shape under the canopy burst into a brilliant flame.
"Flares," said Brabant, as another fell, blossomed, and blazed.
The response from the marsh lights was instant and furious. More and more of them flickered into being and leaped and danced towards the falling flare, and when it reached the water, they swarmed all over it, their cold fire mastering its heat and finally drowning it in a cloud of smoke and a chorus of wet little shrieks and sucking noises. Suddenly, Lyra jumped up and ran inside, feeling her way along the length of the boat to a little cabin in the prow. She felt for her bunk, felt the bedside table, moved her hands over the book and the lamp until they found the velvet bag that held the alethiometer. With that safely in both hands, she moved back through the boat, conscious of the little movements Brabant was making with the tiller and the throttle, of the roar from the Zeppelin's engine somewhere above, of the moaning of the wind. From the galley, she saw Brabant outlined against the flickering marsh lights, and then she was in the doorway again and sat on the bench from where she could see the sky.
"You all right?" said Brabant.
"Yes. I'm going to see what I can find out." She was already turning the little wheels of the alethiometer and peering close in the intermittent glimmer to try and make out the symbols. But it was no good. They were more or less invisible. She held the instrument between her palms and stared fiercely out at the flickering jack-o'-lanterns, aware of a powerful contradiction that almost tore her mind in two. What she wanted to do would involve this secret commonwealth of Brabant's, and yet she told herself it was nonsense, superstition, nothing but meaningless fancy. The Zeppelin was turning around ahead of them, its searchlight probing the rain and the dark marsh gloom below it. Another minute or two, and it would be facing them, and once it had the Maid of Portugal fixed in the glare of the light, nothing would save them.
"Pan, Pan, Pan," Lyra thought. "I need you now, you little bastard, you traitor."
She tried to imagine gathering all the jack-o'-lanterns as if she was herding sheep, but it was so difficult, because after all, she had no imagination, as Pan had said. What would it be like to do that? She thought harder and harder. She tried to think of herself as a light herd, and the absent Pan as a light dog, racing from side to side across the marsh, crouching down still, leaping up again, barking short, sharp commands, running where she thought him to. And how stupid, she thought, how childish. It's just methane or something. It's just natural, meaningless. Her concentration faltered. She heard a sob coming from her throat. Brabant said,
"What are you doing, gal?"
She ignored him. She gritted her teeth. Against her will, she summoned the absent Pan again. A hellhound now, with glowing eyes and slaver flying from his lips, and she saw the terrified marsh lights fleeing and flocking and circling round as the Zeppelin's cold beam of light came closer and closer, and she heard the drumming of rain on the great snout prow of the aircraft, even over the wind and the roar of the engine. She felt something rising inside her, like a tide, wave upon wave of it, growing and receding, and then growing again, a little more each time. And it was anger, it was desire, it was visceral.
"What are they doing? Good God! Look at that!" Brabant was saying.
The marsh lights were speeding and climbing, dashing again and again at a spot on the water just ahead of the Zeppelin searchlight. And then, with a shriek, something rose out of the marsh that wasn't a jack-o'-lantern nor a will-o'-the-wick, but a large bird, a heron, or even a stork, heavy and white and terrified by the darting green glimmers that harried it up and up and into the beam of the searchlight, and higher still, snapping at its legs, crowding like hornets at its great, hefty body as it lumbered up in fear and hurled itself at the aircraft. Brabant said hoarsely,
"Hold tight, gal."
The searchlight beam was nearly on them. Then, in an explosion of fire and blood and white feathers, the heron flew straight into the port engine of the Zeppelin. The aircraft lurched and swung to the left at once, and dipped and sagged as the starboard engine screamed, and the great slug shape drifted sideways and downwards. The tail heaved itself round, caught by the wind with no port engine to stabilize it, and the craft drifted down and down towards the swamp, and closer to the Maid of Portugal, as if it were sinking onto a bed. Little scraps of sound, screams, cries came whirling through the wind and were snatched away again. By the glow of the dancing marsh lights, as well as the fire that was now blazing out of control from the Zeppelin, she and Brabant watched in horror as a figure, two, three, hurled themselves out of the cabin and fell down into the dark. A moment later, the great broken shell of the Zeppelin collapsed onto the water only 50 yards away from them, surrounded by clouds of steam and smoke and flame, and the dance of 1,000 marsh lights capering in triumph. The heat scorched Lyra's face, and Brabant tilted his sou'wester against it. It was horrible to watch, but she couldn't look away. The skeleton of the airship showed black against the great blaze of light, and then it crumpled together and fell in with a cascade of sparks and smoke.
"They won't survive that. None of them," said Brabant. "They be all dead now."
"Horrible."
"Aye."
He moved the throttle lever, and the boat moved out into the middle of the watercourse and gathered speed slowly.
"That heron," Lyra said shakily. "The marsh lights were chasing it. They made it fly up into the engine. They knew what they were doing."
"And so did I," she thought.
"I made it happen."
"A heron, was it? Might have been. I thought it was a flying boggart. They do fly, some of them, making a kind of a whirring noise. Only there was so much else going on, we couldn't have heard that. That's probably what it was. Flying elf, or a spirit out the waters. Something from the secret commonwealth, what I told you about. Look at the jack-o'-lanterns now."
The marsh lights, dozens of them, had all gathered around the burning wreck, making little darts towards it and out again, flickering and dancing.
"What are they doing?"
"Looking for any survivors. They'll pull them down under the water and finish them off." "Them potatoes done yet?"
Yes.
"Well, don't let them get cold. Tell you what, there's a tin of bully beef in the locker. Chop it up with the potatoes and fry the lot. I'm getting peckish."
Lyra felt sick. She couldn't help thinking of the dead men from the Zeppelin, burned or drowned, or worse, and of that beautiful white bird, driven up without mercy into the blades of the engine. Food was the last thing she wanted just then. But when the hash was cooking, she found that, after all, it was a shame to waste it, and it did smell good. So she brought 2 plates of it to the cockpit, where Brabant began by scooping up a forkful and dropping it over the side.
"For the will of the wicks," he said.
She did the same with hers, and then they ate their supper, sheltering their plates from the rain. Chapter 14. The Café Cosmopolitan. That same evening, Dick Orchard pushed open the door and went into the public bar of the Trout. He knew many of Oxford's pubs, but like everyone else, he had his favourites, and the Trout was too far out of the way for him to visit often. Still, the beer was good. He ordered a pint and looked around warily. There was no one among the customers who looked like a scholar. A group of old men playing cards near the fireplace. 2 men who looked like farm workers, stolidly working their way through a long and winding argument about stock fencing. 2 younger couples ordering a meal. Nothing more than a quiet night in a traditional waterside pub. When the meal had been ordered, and the younger couples were sitting down with their drinks, Dick spoke to the barman, a hefty man of 60 or so, with thinning red hair and a genial expression.
"Excuse me, mate," Dick said. "I'm looking for someone called Malcolm Polstead. Do you know him?"
"He's my son," said the barman. "He's in the kitchen at the moment, having a bite of supper. You want to speak to him?"
"Oh, when he's finished. No hurry."
"You've only just caught him, as a matter of fact. He's leaving shortly for somewhere abroad."
"Oh, is he? Lucky I came when I did, then."
Nah, he's got to go and sort out some of his affairs at the university, and then he'll be catching a train. I don't think he's got all that long. He'll be off by tomorrow night, latest, I guess. Why don't you take your drink over to the corner table, and I'll let him know you're here, and he can come and say hello before he leaves. What name is it?"
"Dick Orchard. You won't know it, though. It's about Lyra."
The barman's eyes widened. He leaned a little closer and said quietly, "You know where she is?"
No, but she told me the name Malcolm Polstead, so...
I'll get him now.
Dick took his pint and sat down at the corner table. Something in the barman's manner made him wish he'd come here sooner. Less than a minute later, a tall man, not quite as hefty as his father, the landlord, but still someone Dick would have hesitated to tangle with, sat down at the table with him. He held a mug of tea in one hand, and he was wearing a brown corduroy suit. His demon, a large ginger cat, touched noses courteously with Dick's vixen, Bindi. Dick held out his hand, and Polstead shook it firmly.
"You know something about Lyra?" he said.
He spoke quietly, but his voice was very clear. It was deep and resonant. The voice of a singer, perhaps. Dick was puzzled. It wasn't surprising to know the man was a scholar because of the intelligence in his face, but he had the air of someone who knew his way around the real world.
"Yeah," said Dick. She's a friend. She came round my house the other morning because she was in trouble, she said, and she asked if I could help her. She wanted to get to the Fens, you see, and my granddad's Egyptian, and he happened to be in Oxford just then with his boat, and I gave her a... I told her how to introduce herself to him. I think she must have done that and gone off with him. She told me about something that had happened down near the Oxpens, by the river, and,
what was that?
She saw someone being killed.
Malcolm liked the look of this boy. He was nervous, but he didn't let it get in the way of speaking clearly and frankly.
"How did you know my name?" Malcolm said. "Did Lyra tell you?"
"She said you knew about that business by the river, and she'd been staying here in the Trout, but she had to go, because..."
He was finding it hard to say. Malcolm waited. Dick looked around, and leaned in closer, and finally said, almost in a whisper,
"She felt... the thing was, her demon, Pan, he'd gone. He wasn't with her. He'd just disappeared."
And Malcolm thought, "Of course. Of course. This changes everything."
"I'd never seen anyone like that," Dick went on in the same tone. "You know, separated. She was frightened, and she thought everyone would be looking at her, or worse. There was someone she knew in the Fens, an old Egyptian man. She knew she'd be safe with him, and she thought my granddad might be able to take her there."
"What's his name?"
"My granddad, Giorgio Brabant."
"And the man in the Fens?"
"I dunno, she never said."
"What did she have with her?"
"Just a rucksack."
"What time is this?"
"Quite early, I'd just come home. I worked the night shift at the Royal Mail."
"Was it you told Lyra about Benny Morris?"
"Yeah, I did."
Dick wanted to ask whether Malcolm had found out anything about that man, but he held his tongue. Malcolm was taking out a notebook and pencil. He wrote something down and tore out the page.
"You can trust these two people," he said. "They both know Lyra well. They'll be anxious to know where she's gone. If you could tell them what you just told me, I'd be very obliged. And if you have the time to come out here, my mother and father would be glad to know if you hear any more from her. But don't tell anyone else."
He passed over the paper, on which he'd written Alice's name and address, and Hannah's.
"You going abroad, then?" Dick said.
"Yes. I wish I didn't have to.
Listen, there's a possibility that Pan, that her demon, might turn up. He'll be just as vulnerable as she is. If he knows you, he might do what she did and ask for help." "I thought people died when they got separated like that. I couldn't believe it when I saw her."
"Not always.
Tell me,
do you know anything about a man called Simon Talbot?"
"Never heard of him. Is he something to do with this?"
"Quite possibly. What's your address, by the way?"
Dick told him, and Malcolm wrote it down.
"You going away for long?" said Dick.
"No way of telling at the moment. Oh, one of the people on that piece of paper, Dr. Ralph, will be interested in anything else you can tell her about Benny Morris. He'll be back to work soon."
"You seen him then?"
"Yes."
"Did he do it?"
"He said he didn't."
"Are you... you ain't police, are you?"
"No. Just a scholar. Look, I've got to go. Lots to do before I can leave. Thanks for coming here, Dick. When I get back, I'll buy you a drink."
He stood up, and they shook hands. "Cheers, then," said Dick, and watched as Malcolm made his way out of the bar.
"He moves easy for a big man," he thought.
At about the same time, Pantalaimon was crouching in the shadow of a derelict warehouse near a wharf in the Thames estuary, watching three sailors steal a ship's propeller. There wasn't much light from the sky. A few stars flickered between the ragged clouds, and the moon was somewhere else. There was a feeble glow from the ambaric bulkhead light on the warehouse wall, but very little else to see by except the naphtha lantern in the prow of the rowing boat that had wavered across the creek from a battered old schooner tied up further along the wharf. The schooner was called the Elsa, and her captain had spent the day drinking beer after beer and persuading the mate to help him make off with the propeller, which was bolted to the deck of an almost equally squalid-looking coaster that seemed to have no crew at all, and to consist entirely of rust, apart from the 400 weight of phosphor bronze on the foredeck. They'd spent hours looking at it through the captain's cracked binoculars, and speculating about how much it would fetch in a tolerant shipyard, while two deckhands languidly tossed various splintered planks and bits of rope overboard, the remains of a badly stowed deck cargo that had come apart after a storm in the channel and was now never going to be paid for. The tide was coming in, and the jetsam was floating slowly upstream over the rotting skeleton of a barge and the broken bottles and tin cans in the mud as the silent water gradually lifted the coaster upright. Pantalaimon was watching intently. He'd been interested in the Elsa since he'd arrived at the filthy little harbour the night before, and heard German conversation on the deck. From what he could make out, they were intending to leave with the tide and cross the channel, heading north for Cuxhaven near Hamburg. That was when Pan knew he'd have to go with them. Cuxhaven lay at the mouth of the River Elbe, and the city of Wittenberg, where Gottfried Brander lived, lay many miles inland on the same river. It couldn't be better. The crew of the Elsa had been waiting for a cargo, but someone had let them down, or, more likely from what Pan could gather, the skipper had simply got the date wrong. All day long, the captain and the mate had bickered on the deck, drinking beer and tossing the bottles over the side, and finally, when the skipper agreed to split the proceeds 50-50, the mate gave in and said he'd help liberate the propeller. Pan saw his chance to get aboard the Elsa, and as soon as the rowing boat began to move across the creek towards the coaster, he crept silently along the wharf and darted up the gangplank. There were four crewmen, apart from the skipper and the mate. One of them was rowing the boat, another two were asleep below decks, and the fourth was leaning on the rail watching the expedition. The Elsa was older than Pan could guess, patched and mended over and over, her sails worn and shoddy, her deck filthy with grease and rust. "Plenty of places to hide, anyway," thought Pan, and he sat in the shadow of the wheelhouse and watched the thieves clambering up onto the coaster. At least, the mate climbed up, after the skipper tried twice and failed. The mate was a youngish man, lean and long-limbed, whereas the skipper was swag-bellied, bow-legged, and three-quarters drunk, and he'd never see 60 again. But he was determined. He stood up in the unstable dinghy, hand on the side of the coaster, growling orders at the mate, who was trying to free the nearest davit from enough rust to let it swing out over the water. He kept up a stream of curses and abuse until the mate leaned over the side and snarled back at him. The mate's herring-gull demon added a sardonic squawk. Pan knew no more German than Lyra did, of course, but it wasn't hard to understand the drift of the conversation. Finally, the mate got the davit to move, and then turned his attention to the propeller. The skipper was refreshing himself from a bottle of rum, while his parrot demon clung half insensible to the gunwale. The oily water was slipping into the creek without a murmur, bringing with it ragged clumps of scum and the body of an animal so dead it was more than half rotted away. Pan looked at the crewman who was watching from the Elsa, and at his demon, a scabby-looking rat who sat at his feet cleaning her whiskers. He looked back at the little scene across the creek, with the crewman drooping over the oars, more than half asleep, and the mate wielding a spanner on the deck of the coaster above, and the skipper clinging with one hand to a rope hanging from the davit, while the other hand lifted the bottle to his lips again. Into Pan's mind came a memory of the night scene from the allotments near the Oxpens, with the Royal Mail depot across the meadow, the wisps of steam rising from the sidings, the bare trees by the river, the distant clank of wire on mooring post, everything silver and calm and beautiful. And motionless, he felt a thrill of wild exultation at the loveliness of these things, and at how the universe was so full of them. He thought how much he loved Lyra, and how much he missed her, her warmth, her hands, and how much she would have loved to be here with him watching, how they would have whispered together and pointed out this detail or that, how her breath would have caressed the delicate fur of his ears. What was he doing? And what was she doing without him? That little question wormed into his mind, and he flicked it out. He knew what he was doing. Something had made Lyra immune to the intoxication of night beauty such as this. Something had robbed her of that vision, and he would find it and bring it back to her, and they would never be apart again, and stay together as long as they lived. The mate had freed the propeller, and was looping the rope round and round it, ignoring the growled instructions from the skipper, while the oarsman paddled lethargically to keep the dinghy roughly under the davit. Pantalaimon wanted to see what happened when they lowered the propeller into the boat, and whether the dinghy would sink under it. But he was tired, more than tired, almost delirious with exhaustion. So he prowled the length of the deck until he found a companionway, and then crept down into the bowels of the Elsa, found a dark spot, and curled up, and fell asleep at once. Speeches long and short, motions for and motions against, objections, qualifications, amendments, protests, votes of confidence, more speeches, and yet further speeches, had filled the first day of the magisterial conference with argument, and the council chamber of the Secretariat of the Holy Presence with warm, stale air. Marcel Delamere sat through every word, patient, attentive, and inscrutable. His owl demon did close her eyes once or twice, but only to ponder, not to sleep. They broke at 7 for a service of vespers, followed by dinner. There was no formal seating arrangement. Groups of allies seated themselves together, while those with no acquaintance among the other delegates, or those who realized the small influence their own organization could wield, sat wherever they could find space. Delamere watched it all, observing, counting, calculating, but at the same time greeting, exchanging a word here or a joke there, being prompted by a murmur from his demon when it would be wise to lay a friendly hand on a shoulder or a forearm, and when a silent twinkle of complicity would be more effective. He paid particular, though unobtrusive, attention to the representatives of the large corporations who were sponsoring, in the most ethically conscious and again unobtrusive way, some aspects of the arrangements. Medical insurance, that sort of thing. When he sat down to eat, it was between two of the least powerful and most timid delegates there, the aged patriarch of the Sublime Porte in Constantinople, and the abbess of the Order of St. Julian, a tiny body of nuns, who by a historical fluke had come to manage a large fortune in stocks and shares and government bonds.
"What did you make of the arguments today, Monsieur Delamere?" said the abbess.
"All very well put, I thought," he said. "Cogent, honest, from the heart."
"And where does your organization stand on the matter?"
said the Patriarch Papadakis, St. Simeon by courtesy.
"We stand with the majority."
"And which way will the majority vote, do you think?"
"Well, they will vote with me, I hope." He could assume a pleasant tone when he needed to, and the gentle jocularity of his expression made it clear to his neighbours that this was a jest. They smiled politely. The candlelight on the long oak tables, the aroma of roast venison, the chink of cutlery on fine porcelain plates, the heady glow of the crimson wine and the golden wine, the unobtrusive, swift skill of the servants, it was all very pleasing. Even the abbess, who lived frugally, found herself approving of these arrangements.
"The Secretariat of the Holy Presence is certainly looking after us very well," she said.
"You can always rely on—"
"Delamere, there you are," said a loud voice, emphasized by a heavy hand on his shoulder. Delamere knew who it was before he turned to look. Only one man interrupted so readily and so rudely.
"Pierre," Delamere said blandly, "can I help?"
"We haven't been told about the arrangements for the final plenary session,"
said Pierre Binot, the Chief Justice of the CCD.
Why's that been left off the schedule?
It hasn't. Ask someone from the Office of Ceremonial and they'll explain.
Said Binot, and left frowning.
I do beg your pardon, Delamere said to the abbess. Yes, the secretariat. Well, we can always rely on Monsieur Hudebert, the prefect. He has a perfect knowledge of how to make events like these move with unruffled serenity.
But tell me, monsieur, said the patriarch, what do you make of the recent troubles we've been having in the Levant?
I think you're very wise to use the word troubles, said Delamere, filling the old man's water glass. More than anxieties, but less than alarms,
Well, from the viewpoint of Geneva, perhaps.
No, I don't mean to downplay their importance, your serenity. They are indeed troubling, but it's just this sort of trouble that makes it important for us to speak with one voice and act with one purpose.
Well, that's what has been so difficult to achieve, said the patriarch, for us in our eastern churches to feel that we have the authority of the entire magisterium behind us would certainly be a blessing. Things are getting harder, you know, monsieur. There is more discontent than I have ever known among our people in their cities and markets and villages. A new doctrine seems to be arising that holds a great attraction for them. We try to confront it, but...
He spread his old hands helplessly. That is precisely what the new representative council will be perfectly placed to deal with, said Delamere, with warm sincerity. Believe me, the effectiveness of the magisterium will be greatly magnified. Our truth, of course, is eternal and unchangeable, but our methods have been hampered over the centuries by the need to consult, to advise, to listen, to placate. It is action that your situation cries out for, and the new council will deliver that. The patriarch looked solemn and nodded. Delamere turned to the abbess. Mother, what is the feeling among your sisters about your place in the hierarchy? He said. May I help you to some more wine?
How kind. Thank you. Well, we don't have views, really, Monsieur Delamere. It's not our place to have opinions. We are here to serve.
And very faithfully you do it. But you know, ma'am, I didn't say views, I said feelings. You can argue someone out of their views, but feelings go much deeper and speak more truly.
Oh, that is certainly true, monsieur. Our place in the hierarchy... Well, I suppose our feeling about that would be one of modesty and gratitude, humility. We don't presume to feel discontented with our lot.
Quite right. I hoped you'd say that. No, I knew you'd say it. A really good woman would say nothing else. Now... He dropped his voice a little and leaned towards her. Suppose a representative council were to emerge from this Congress. Would it please your holy sisters if their abbess were to have a seat on that council? The good lady was speechless. She opened her mouth twice and closed it again. She blinked. She blushed. She shook her head and then stopped and almost nodded. You see, Delamere went on, there's a particular kind of holiness that I think is underrepresented in the magisterium. It's the kind that serves, as your holy sisters do, but serves with a true modesty and not a false one. A false modesty would be ostentatious, don't you think? It would seek to turn away emphatically from public distinctions and offices while privately lobbying to get them, and then allow itself to be dragged into them,
protesting volubly about its unworthiness. I'm sure you've seen that cast of mine. But true modesty would accept that there is a place that one could fill, that one's talents are not illusions, that it would be wrong to turn away from a task if one could do it well. Don't you think? The abbess was looking warm. She sipped her wine and coughed as she swallowed too much at once. Delamere tactfully looked away till she'd recovered.
"Monsieur, you speak very generously," she said in what was nearly a whisper.
"Not generous, mother, merely juste." Her demon was a mouse with pretty silver fur. He had been hiding on her shoulder, out of sight of Delamere's owl demon, who, sensing their nervousness, had not looked at him once. But now he appeared, just a face and whiskers, and the owl slowly turned and bowed her head to him. The mouse just gazed with bright button eyes, but didn't retreat. Presently he crept around onto the abbess's other shoulder and made a little bow to Delamere's demon. Delamere was talking to the patriarch again, reassuring, flattering, explaining, sympathizing, and inwardly reckoning. Two more votes. As the first day of the magisterial conference drew to an end, some of the delegates withdrew to their rooms to read, or to write letters, or to pray, or just to sleep. Others gathered in groups to talk over the day's events. Some with old friends, some with new acquaintances who seemed to be agreeable or of like opinions or better informed about the politics that lay behind the gathering. One such group sat with glasses of brandy wine near the great fireplace in the Salon des Etrangers. The chairs were comfortable, the spirits unusually smooth, the room skillfully lit so that chairs were grouped in pools of illumination, with dimmer areas between, isolating each group in a way that reinforced its identity and made it comfortable to be in. As well as money, the Secretariat of the Holy Presence had gifted and experienced designers. The group by the fire had assembled almost by accident, but they soon found themselves in a state of warm agreement, almost complicity in fact. They were discussing the personalities who had made most impact during the day. The prefect of the secretariat, naturally, as their host, was one of these.
"A man of calm authority, he seems to me," said the dean of the court of faculties.
"And much experience in the world. Do you know how much property the secretariat owns?" said the preceptor of the temple hospitalers.
"No. Is it a great deal?"
"I understand they command funds reaching into the tens of billions, much due to his skill in the world of banking."
Murmurs of admiration went around the little group.
"Someone else who made an impression, I think," said the chaplain of the Synod of Deacons, "perhaps in a different way, was Saint the Patriarch of the Constantinople, a very holy man."
"Indeed," said the dean, "Saint Simeon. We are lucky to have him among us."
"He's led his organization for 50 years, no less," said a man none of the others recognized. He was a dapper Englishman, wearing a faultlessly cut tweed suit and a bow tie. With increasing wisdom, no doubt, but perhaps in recent years a little lessening of strength, moral authority undiminished, of course. Nods of assent. The dean said,
"Very true. I'm afraid I don't recognize you, sir. Which body do you represent?"
"Oh, I'm not a delegate," said the Englishman. "I'm reporting on the Congress for the Journal of Moral Philosophy. My name is Simon Talbot."
I think I've read something of yours," said the chaplain. "A very witty piece about relativism."
"How very kind," said Talbot.
"It's the younger men who hold the future," said a man in a dark suit, who was an executive of Thuringia Potash, one of the corporate sponsors, a powerful pharmaceutical company. "Such as the Secretary General of La Maison Juste."
"Marcel Delamere."
"That's it. An extraordinarily able man.
Yes, Monsieur Delamere is a remarkable man. He seems very keen to promote this idea of a council, said the preceptor.
Well, frankly, so are we, said the Thuringia Potash executive. And I think it would do well to include your Monsieur Delamere in its ranks.
A clarity of mind, a vigor of perception, murmured Simon Talbot. All in all, Marcel Delamere could be pleased with his day's work. The Café Cosmopolitain, opposite the railway station in Geneva, was a long, rectangular, low-ceilinged room, badly lit, not very clean, the only decoration on the smoke-brown walls being placards of chipped enamel or faded paper advertising aperitifs or spirits. There was a zinc-topped bar along one side, and staff apparently chosen for their freedom from the constraints of courtesy and competence. If you wanted to get drunk,